Meet Reed Lance Rosenthal, rancher, number one best-selling award-winning author, and unabashedly, unapologetically, on the right side of the outstanding issues of our generation. But don't try to fence him in. Sometimes his positions will surprise you, because Reed is definitely his own man, with his own opinions. You might love him, you might hate him, but you won't be able to stop listening. Step over to the right side with Reed.
Happy Saturday, folks. It's Reed Lance Rosenthal on the Right Side Radio. Wow. Once again, right? Action-packed. Where do you start? I think I have quite a show for you this morning. We're going to have a historical story, which unfortunately you're going to find apropos to today's situation. We're going to have our rat-a-tat-tat. Some from last week I never got to, and some more crazy stuff from this week, which will, it'll make your lips pucker and your eyes roll. That's all I can tell you. And I had several emails, actually a bunch of emails. I brought up 2 weeks ago the fact that an employer cannot force you. In fact, nobody can force you to take this vaccine. It is federal law. So long as it is not fully approved by the FDA, CDC, blah, 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 you know, the rest of the acronym health Nazis. Because I got all these emails wanting to know more about this, I did some research, found a great law article. I'm going to be going over that with you to give you the details of your legal right to refuse this vaccine. And it is illegal for anybody to force you, including your employer. It will cost them a check, and that will be a check to you. So, you know, if you want to stand up, I'm going to tell you how to do it. We're going to be talking about some very interesting developments in the election fraud arena. You know, HR1 is wending its way now through the Senate, the attempt to solidify, codify election theft. Although a lot of it will be struck down as unconstitutional, and much of it is overstepping and overreaching the federal government's ability to control the states. Putting that aside, very interesting developments on the election fraud deal, some court cases, and what's happening in some of these forensic audits, and also what's happening with some of the Dominion employees, that company that just... everything was above board, and it didn't switch a single vote, and their systems are just perfect. Mm-hmm. You bet. We're going to talk just a sliver about reparations, because there's more reparations. You know, Evanston, Illinois, I talked to you about it the last 2 weeks. Yeah, they passed it, so they got that going. I'll bring you up to speed on that, and now we have Oakland, California jumping into the fray. Crazy Oakland. We're going to talk a little bit about gun control. Once again, just a brush to keep you up to speed, because it's unsolidified. And there's no sense talking about stuff which could-bes, may-bes, or whatever. I'm going to talk to you again about what you need to do. We all need to stand up. We need to stand up now. We need to step up, and we need to stop crying about where we're at. We are where we at. And there is nothing we can do about it except dust our fannies off and do what we have to do. Your family depends on it. Future generations depend on it. Your freedoms depend on it. And your country depends on it. I'm going to talk just a tad about the economy. There's a measure that you don't know, which is called money velocity. There's money supply and money velocity. Very interesting statistics starting to emerge now on money velocity, which it's kind of like a canary in the economic coal mine. In fact, I did a show, 2 years ago. It was very, very, very popular, called The Canary in the Economic Coal Mine. If you go to the website on therightsideradio.com, you can type in those words, canary in the economic coal mine, and listen to that show. And then finally, except that I'm going to be really spending some big time on it in this show to make up for not getting to it in the last two shows, except China weaves through everything I'm talking about. We're going to spend some big time on China. And we're going to start revealing all the sordid interactings, all the sordid invasions, all the frightening infiltrations that the Chinese have been successful on the business side, on the personal side, on the big tech side, and yes, in the halls of Congress, the White House, and the agencies of the United States government side. One thing about the Chinese is they're good. They play long ball, and they have this mapped out. And it all ties in with the coronavirus and whatever's coming next after these vaccines. So, let's get started. You know, there have been many empires over the course of history. There have been many powerful nations, you know, super powerful nations over the course of history. But really, there's only been five superpowers over the course of history. We're going to talk about those superpowers, and we're going to examine the common thread which brought them down. So, the list, by the way, does not include such notable names, particularly for you folks who follow history of old. It does not include the Egyptians, or the Song Dynasty, or the Mayans, or the Incas, or the Iroquois Nation here in North America. Superpowers are defined not only by their power, but by their reach. Is their reach global, not regional? Did they have staying power? In other words, were they around a century or more? Many of these other empires were around far shorter periods or kept their reach to just their own neighborhood, shall we say. The Persian Empire, the Spanish Empire, the Arab Empire, the Mauryan Empire, the Tang Dynasty. All these come to great powers. All of them come to very strong, although short-lived, relatively speaking, empires. But the empires were localized. They were regional. Now we're going to talk about the superpowers. The superpowers of their day, and obviously that changes the substance and the nature of what is a superpower is relative to its time in history. The first, of course, was the Roman Empire. It reached the height of its power in the 2nd century. And it was the dominant power. Its power didn't go as far as India and China, but the Roman Empire basically controlled the Middle East and Europe and all the major population centers and civilizations of antiquity, Greece, Egypt, the Levant, Carthage, Anatolia, Italy. At its height, there were 60 million people under Roman rule, which, by the way, was 25% of the world's population at that time. The Roman Empire is really interesting because of its size, its just sheer geographic size, its ability to access resources, and its population, it did not have to trade much. The only thing it really needed was to acquire luxury resources, silk, spices, incense, that kind of thing. It was militarily dominant. Nothing could stand up to the Roman legions except in an occasional conflict or two. The only empire which could rival it, and it was not much of a rivalry, was Persia. But its power was nowhere equal to Rome's. Rome ultimately fell, folks, not because of external threats, but due to continuous civil war. In the end, two emperors, the Emperor of the East and the Emperor of the West, economic depredations, and an overall reliance on mercenaries. And then we go to the Mongol Empire. The Mongol Empire was the world's largest land empire. The empire's rise, by the way, to this great ascendancy of power was all the more amazing because basically the Mongol Empire was a group of Mongol tribes that numbered no more than 1 million. It's pretty amazing. And they managed to conquer empires that were hundreds of times bigger. And they achieved that they had outstanding tactics. They were highly mobile. They were savage. They incorporated the technology of everybody they conquered and the logistics. In other words, the ability to move men and supplies also from those that they conquered. The warlord Temujin, he united all these Mongol tribes in 1206. He was 50 years old, by the way, which is pretty old. And he was acclaimed the universal ruler by these united tribes. Genghis Khan, they called him. That ring a bell? After he conquered northern China, he conquered Central Asia. And he used as an excuse his Mongol ambassadors being killed there. There's some question in history as to whether he had them killed there to create the excuse, by the way. Gee, does that sound familiar? Oh, we'll be talking about that. He conquered Central Asia by 1221, and then he conquered Iran, the Persians. And by the way, he was known for just incredible brutality. 15 to 50 million people. Understand how many people that was in that time. This is a large chunk of the world's population. 15 to 50 million people in that region died. Most of the population, in fact, of Central Asia. You either went along with Genghis or you didn't go along at all. You went away. Genghis Khan's heirs ruled an empire that went on to conquer Eurasia, most of the Middle East, parts of Eastern Europe, China, and Russia. And in the end, kind of like Rome, we're getting a common thread here. Its empire fragmented into four what was known as Khanates, Chanates, which each in turn collapsed or were conquered. By the way, interesting sidelight. To understand how ruthless the Mongols were and Genghis Khan were, and how proliferous he was, 8% of the world's men have some kind of genotype from Genghis Khan. 8% of the men on the planet Earth have some type of genotype from Genghis Khan. Pretty amazing. Then we come to the British Empire. Now, the British Empire grew out of colonial and trading ventures, and it was the first empire that really based its power on its navy and its commerce. And it became history's largest empire. It covered a full quarter of the world's surface. You know, you've heard the phrase, right? So large that the sun never set on it. At its height, the British Empire lorded over a fifth of the world's population. And obviously, by that time, the world's population was substantially increased from the days of Rome and the Mongols. The basis of Britain's power was its navy. It allowed Britain to enforce freedom of navigation, oppose slavery, oppose piracy, and in general bring a sense of power to far corners of the earth that a land army far away just couldn't project. It was a very diverse empire. And what the British did was they didn't focus on large land areas of control. They focused on points of control. The points of control that controlled trade and commerce. For instance, Suez, Malacca, Aden, Hormuz, Gibraltar, right? Think about all these straits that controlled and still do maritime routes. That was the focus of their control. And the British, over time, they didn't like send out Roman legions or Roman governors to administer their conquered territories. Instead, they kind of absorbed the local rulers, trained the local rulers with just some British, should we say, admiralty involved, and let the local rulers serving the crown back there in London, the local rulers continue to rule their local territories. That was true in India, in Egypt, in Canada. I mean, that's how diverse this empire was. But despite its enormous global reach, its incredible and unmatched navy, and its ground forces, which, when employed, were among the most formidable in the world, and its tremendous wealth through its many decades as a superpower, basically controlling the trade of the entire planet, the British Empire, and as a superpower, collapsed. There were many reasons for it, and coming right up will be those reasons. I think you're going to find some startling similarities to today's events. While many factors contributed to the fall of Britain, the United Kingdom, as a superpower, I think you can trace them back to five key components. First, Britain became slow on the uptake in terms of confronting its enemies. It allowed rival powers to amass great power of their own and to build formidable armies and navies, some of which, although they couldn't quite outmatch the Royal Navy, could certainly hold their own against it. And then Britain went into a program of, shall we say, giving things away. And when I say giving things away, I mean giving things away to its own subjects. Yes, it was a capitalist nation, very capitalist, but in order to keep the masses happy, there began to be the very beginnings of social programs which sapped the British treasury, diverted funds from its defense, and diverted attention away from the rising power of other countries, particularly, by the way, Germany and some of its satellite nations prior to World War I. And then finally, Britain took its eyes off the ball. Instead of keeping control of these various choke points of commerce around the world, what they did was they allowed local rule to kind of take over these various places. More so, by the way, than what they had set up to begin with, which was rather brilliant. When you take all these factors, and you take the rise of these other powers, which Britain pretty much ignored, you know, that old, it can't happen here. We are the British Empire. Nothing can stop us. The results were disastrous. And by the end of World War I, Britain was no longer a superpower. In fact, its empire was cut by more than 60% in that First World War. That brings us to the Soviet Union, the next great superpower. You know, it was inevitable, if you look at history, with the size of Russia and the resources of the Soviet Union, that they would not become a superpower. The Soviet Union inherited most of the population and territory of the Russian Empire. Remember, I've brought you the story of how Lenin came to power back in 1917. And the empire had grown so large that it was called the Prison of Nations. In other words, it went from Russia to the Soviet Union because of all the countries that it conquered in one way or the other. And the very basis of Soviet power, was its immense size. I mean, look at a global map. It is enormous relative to any and all other countries. And it made it very difficult to conquer by land. Hitler would discover that, by the way, in World War II. And it allowed the Russians to marshal weather in their favor and to muster just sheer distance that armies would have to travel to defeat the Soviet Union in its favor. The West was really the only adversary of the Soviet Union. And the Soviets were obsessed with security. So Soviet armies continued to roll on and on in all sorts of directions, in all sorts of hellhole corners of the world, like, you know, Afghanistan. And it culminated, the Soviet superpower and the Soviet Empire, with the occupation of Eastern Europe and most of Northeast Asia following World War II. In the end, the Soviet Union collapsed just because it was overextended. It was too many places doing too many things at one time. Its economy, and as a small country population-wise, was never great. It kind of relied on its conquered countries to bolster the overall GDP of what was then the Soviet Union, as opposed to Mother Russia. And in the end, folks, all wars and all ascensions and descents of superpowers are economic. In fact, almost completely economic. It is downward spiraling economies that create the opportunities for armies. And the Soviet Union was no exception. In the end, the Soviet Union collapsed because it basically ran out of money. And you could thank Ronald Reagan for that, because he foresaw quite cleverly and with good intelligence exactly what the Soviet Union was and where it was. And basically, building on their penchant, their lust for security, he embarked on an incredible militarization of the American superpower empire, which we're going to be talking about next. The Soviet Union could not compete, and in the end, they went broke. And that was the end of the Soviet Union. Now, that brings us to the American period, the American century, as it's called. America's superpower status shared with the Soviet Union for a while, and then really captured by America and maintained by America from 1984, give or take, the mid-1980s, until now. The American superpower empire and America's evolution into a global, in fact, the first really true global superpower was the aftermath of World War II. America was home at that time, this is an amazing statistic, to half, 50% of the world's GDP. Think about that. One country on the planet was home to 50% of all of the economic engine that powered the entire world. For four decades, the Soviet Union rivaled it, but the United States was always stronger because of its economy, its geography, and its alliances. Since the fall of the Soviet Union, militarily, technology, and economically, it has enjoyed almost total dominance in the air, on the seas, and a conventional land advantage in terms of its military forces. And the United States, while each of the previous superpowers of history relied on kind of a single, or in some cases a dual strategy of expansion, the acquisition of wealth, and the maintenance of power, the United States was the first to combine basically all the best features of all the previous superpowers. It controls an enormous continental-sized resource-rich territory like the Soviet Union, has an incredibly strong military that can wreak total havoc on its enemies like the Mongols. Like the Roman Empire, America has, up till now, no military rival. Most importantly, though, America, like Britain, built its power on the basis of a non-finite, a non-territorial resource, i.e. commerce. And like Britain, America has a superb navy, although it was kind of ransacked in the Obama years, that can access all the world's major sea routes and protect the basis of American power, which is commerce and, yes, the economy. All superpowers to date in history have, should we say, ended, have declined into something less than a superpower. And all superpowers in history have had satellite nations which contributed to the success of the superpower and to the security of the superpower. For instance, Canada. And this is important. Canada, just looking at one. You know, while the United States may have been the chief architect of the current world system, others now leverage that system far better than America does. For instance, Canada was number 6 in the Heritage Foundation Wall Street Journal Index of Economic Freedom. And as you know, there's quite a bit of socialist tendencies in Canada. Australia, by the way, was number 3. And Australia could also be considered a satellite to the American Empire. Think about Canada. It has all these advantages. It's protected by NATO, which is, at least to date, the world's best military alliance. It has access to all sorts of emerging opportunities in the Arctic, which is resource-rich. It has tremendous energy resources. And, of course, it sits right next door to the world's best marketplace, i.e., the United States. Now, one of the things in recent history that has occurred is that ascending powers have infiltrated and tried to capture the attention, devotion, and yes, loyalty of the satellite powers of the superpowers. China has done an excellent job. China buys much of Canada's resources and energy. Chinese troops, I don't know if you know this or not, 50,000 of them, actually train in Canada, sometimes on their own, sometimes in concert with Canadian forces. And China's tentacles stretch all throughout Canadian commerce and government, just as they do and we'll be discussing in this show here in America. China has also infiltrated Australia. China has also infiltrated Britain and Europe, all the satellite countries of the American superpower empire. The end result might not be great, shall we say. I'm going to be coming back to this historical story, because it will be formed the basis, really, of many of the segments in today's show. The segments which are purely American, I'll call them, will point out, you'll see some similarities in what has brought down the superpowers of the last 3,000 years. And you'll see tremendous similarities in the rise of opposing powers unchecked by the superpower, one of Britain's great fallouts. But right now we're going to move into the COVID vaccine and the law, since I've had so many emails on it. Look, nobody can force you to take this vaccine. We're going to talk over the next 2 weeks about these so-called passports and, you know, vaccine documentation and all this nonsense. In fact, New York State, of course, is putting into place a vaccine passport program to attend social events or go to restaurants. It's all illegal, assuming we keep control of the Supreme Court. And it is all against federal law. And that's the same with employers. They cannot threaten you or fire you for not taking an experimental drug. And the Food and Drug Administration at the FDA has only granted emergency use authorization for the Pfizer, Johnson & Johnson, and Moderna vaccines, folks. They are not approved vaccines. They are not even approved drugs. They are emergency use authorization, EUAs as they're called, only. Many of these organizations which are trying to coerce, twist arms, fire people for not doing vaccines, and many of these government entities which with the usual Democratic Marxist overreach are trying to impose even more controls over the population, I think are going to get their hands slapped and going to be writing some big checks to folks that they screw with. The EUAs for Pfizer and Moderna, we'll just take those two, okay? You have to be told that it is your option to not receive the COVID vaccine. You have to be told that by whoever is administering the vaccine. You have to be told that by anybody who wants you to take the vaccine. That is the law. And coming up next, I'm going to tell you some more about this law, your protections, and the limitations of their power. Congress granted the authority to issue EUAs, emergency use authorizations, and to the FDA, the NIH, etc. The FDA and the CDC, folks, acknowledge that it's a fundamental requirement of choice that's important enough that even during the height of the so-called scamdemic, they reinforced that policy decision any time and every time they issued their guidance related to these so-called vaccines, which, of course, are not vaccines. We've talked many weeks about that. Any organization or government will be at odds with federal law if it requires its employees, students, or other members to get a COVID-19 vaccine that is being distributed under emergency use authorization, period. State laws in most states prohibits retaliation against an employee for refusing to participate in a violation of federal law. Any organizations, doesn't matter who, that require COVID-19 vaccination in violation of federal law will face lawsuits, and they will lose. And they will be very costly to the defendants. Now, organizations can encourage vaccination, internal communications, educational events, other measures, those kinds of things. Propaganda, as you've probably seen on TV and heard on radio. Okay. But there are controls on that in the law. These measures cannot be coercive. The organization has to make clear that the decision regarding whether to receive this EUA medicine is voluntary. And the measures have to comply with the requirements in the EUAs themselves. You know, my personal opinion is that the phobia over these vaccines is really part of, let me just say this, it has nothing to do with your health. It has nothing to do with stopping a so-called pandemic, which is not a pandemic. Remember last week I talked to you about how the WHO and the CDC and all the health Nazis, along with their buddy Bill Gates, of course, and with full acknowledgement and laughter of the democratic Marxists from around the world, and with the great assistance of, yes, Red China, all these entities, all these people, all these ideologues care not a hoot about your health. This is about something entirely different. Getting back to your rights and their restrictions. So that you know, the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines were approved for EUAs, emergency use authorizations, in December 2020. But the real clinical trials, the clinical trials to date, have been really emergency sped up trials. The real trial's going on right now, isn't it? With hundreds of millions of people around the planet injected, jabbed with these experimental concoctions. And these clinical trials that are ongoing now will be the real trials. They must be completed to get full use authorization and the final seal of approval. In other words, move them off of emergency use status. And these trials that are ongoing right now, folks, are expected to last 2 years. It will be 2 years at least until these medicines are no longer emergency use authorized, but instead, perhaps, approved medicines. At which case, kind of the rights of these organizations that want you to take this or that and your rights to refuse kind of shift a little bit. But we're not there yet, so I'm not going to waste your time or mine talking about it. The EUAs themselves are explicit. Let me quote. An investigational vaccine not licensed for any indication. All promotional material related to the COVID-19 vaccine clearly and conspicuously must state that this product has not been approved or licensed by the FDA, but has been authorized for emergency use by the FDA. Unquote. By the way, this same section of the law, which is the Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act, requires, quote, you must ensure that individuals to whom the product is administered are informed of the option to accept or refuse administration of the product, unquote. Again, quote, ensure that recipients are informed to the extent practicable, given the applicable circumstances, they have the option to accept or refuse the EUA product. So, when Amanda Cohn, she's the executive secretary of the CDC's Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, she was asked very specifically if the COVID-19 vaccination can be required. Here's her response. Under an EUA, vaccines are not allowed to be mandatory. So early in this vaccination phase, individuals will have to be consented and they won't be able to be mandatory. And by the way, that limitation applies even to hospitals, doctors, and others of the same ilk. By the way, this was a great article which was written by Aaron Siri, S-I-R-I, who's one of the managing partners at Siri and Gilmstad LLP, a big law firm back in New York City. Quite interesting. Let's talk about election fraud, shall we? And then we're going to get into our rat-a-tat-tat. It's really curious, folks. I talked to you last week about the reality of the lawsuits out there. There were 85 lawsuits filed by Trump and his supporters and legal teams. All but 22 were dismissed on procedural grounds. There was never an evidentiary hearing. Of the 22 that remained, Trump and allied legal forces won 16 or 68%. And that has triggered several forensic audits, which are ongoing right now in Georgia and Arizona, and there'll be several more coming in other states, including, most likely, Wisconsin and Michigan. Dominion, you know, the machines, the company that says, oh, we're just lily white and we're totally clean. And, you know, well, when we flick the switch, every vote is counted properly and nothing has ever been manipulated, blah, 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 blah. It seems that employees of Dominion are vanishing. In fact, their LinkedIn profiles are gone. Since Election Day, 100 of 243 Dominion workers have taken down their LinkedIn files, or those files were deleted. And what's come up as people realize this is that virtually all, like 99.9% of their software engineers are in Serbia. Oh. So, you know, why is there such a rush to delete personal information and profiles of Dominion employees and software engineers in Serbia? Yeah, right. You know, until Election Day, they were all really proud. They wanted to share their credentials and their biographies with the entire world. And now suddenly, with fraud and manipulation accusations, quote, over 40% of Dominion's employees with profiles on LinkedIn have eliminated their profiles from the social media giant, end quote. And there's several other things which have really piqued my attention on this kind of developing story. Voting machines, it turns out, Dominion or otherwise, and the code that runs them, the all-important code that runs them, you know, the algorithms, you know, Facebook's algorithms and Google's algorithms, well, it turns out that these voting machines have algorithms too. And they don't come from a particularly secure source, you know, Serbia. And according to Computer World, quote, voting machines are privately manufactured and developed, and as with many other IT systems, the code is typically proprietary. Dominion keeps it tightly secret. And next, I'm going to tell you some more interesting tidbits about Dominion, their proprietary rights, etc. Now, you know, you would think that the code used to program voting machines in the United States or anywhere else would be public. You have a public vote. Voting is an inalienable right. The right to have your vote count as one vote relative to all other votes of the citizens. Let me underline that. The citizens, the live citizens of your country, is an inalienable right no matter what country you're in. So why isn't this software stuff being shared? In fact, why haven't the states and the federal government demanded it be shared? Great question, isn't it? You know, that way flaws can be detected and repaired before you have the wreck that we had in 2020. By the way, a place you can give to that's really digging into this is called the Open Source Election Technology Foundation. And they're fighting to make all this stuff public and transparent, going back and in all elections going forward. By the way, Dominion claims that they develop, quote-unquote, their systems in the United States and Canada. They just happen to have an office in Belgrade, Serbia. That's a quote. They just ran an ad. This is really interesting. It makes you wonder what they're up to. To hire, quote, four senior software developers in Belgrade, unquote. And a firm spokesman, assuming this is his real name, Chris Riggle, R-I-G-G-A-L-L, admits, quote, some of our software development is undertaken outside the United States and Canada, specifically in Serbia, where we have conducted operations for 10 years. Oh, what does that bring us back to? That's right, Barack Obama's 2012 election, 10 years. I wonder if that's a coincidence. What do you think? By the way, Dominion insists, I mean, you know, cross their heart, hope to die, that they take any and all measures to, quote, ensure the accuracy, integrity, and security of the software we create for our products, unquote. Look, where the forensics have been done, the forensic studies such as Antrim County, Michigan, it's irrefutable. The machines and their software switched 6,000 votes to Biden from Trump that were later reversed. Antrim, Michigan is only one county out of 36 that uses Dominion machines. In New Hampshire, 300 in local races, Dominion machines automatically subtracted 300, give or take one, votes from every single Republican candidate in local races. Forensic audits are now underway in Georgia and Arizona. It might be quite interesting. By the way, just as another coincidence, you know, the company is part of a globalist network. Oh, our buddies Bill Gates and George Soros and the rest of them, the Davos crowd. But you'll really like this. You know who the lobbyist for Dominion is? It's the assistant of Nancy Pelosi. That's right. Nancy Pelosi's assistant is the lobbyist for Dominion. Oh, boy. However, there is some good news on the election fraud front. Court cases seem to be increasingly going our way, or should I say America's way, you know, one legal vote per person counted accurately. JudicialWatch.org, and they are great folks. I told you about them last week. Send them some money. JudicialWatch.org, they are out there fighting for us everywhere on a whole bunch of fronts, particularly election fraud. They slapped Kentucky. They originally got a judgment against Kentucky to clean up its voter rolls, but Kentucky's Democratic Secretary of State, alt-left, Allison Lundergan Grimes, she just ignored it. You know, that's what Democratic Marxists do. So they didn't clean up the 250,000 names which should not be on the voter rolls, you know, dead people, people who've moved away, illegal aliens, etc., etc., etc. And Judicial Watch has determined that 1.8 million in 353 U.S. counties had more, or let me rephrase this, 353 U.S. counties together had 1.8 million more registered voters than there were eligible voting age citizens in those counties. Think about that, 1.8 million. And then there's all sorts of discrepancies within all sorts of states, ranging from 1.2 million folks, dead folks, folks that don't exist, addresses that are vacant lots, in California, to the lower numbers, like Kentucky, 250,000 that should be purged. Well, the Secretary of State didn't purge it. Judicial Watch just got an order from a very irate federal judge that Kentucky will purge it. They will follow his order, and he's extended his order to 2025, i.e., including the 2022 and 2024 elections. By the way, just as a sidelight, Georgia has almost 20 counties that have more than 100% registered voters than they have eligible voters in their counties, ranging from 100% in Hall County, which is, you know, impossible, to 118% in Bryant County. And all those counties where we know the fraud occurred, like Fulton County, they began the fraud with 109% more registered voters than there are eligible citizens in the county. By the way, Fulton County is one of the counties that's getting audited by another judge's order on the Dominion machines and mail-in ballots. We'll see how that comes out. That's underway right now. JudicialWatch.org. Send them some money. All right. More good news on the election front. The Democratic Marxists in the House are beginning to kind of see the handwriting on the wall with their outrageous, well, outrageous to us, to them, just part of the plan, policies, bills, votes, etc. They're also starting to see these courts make decisions to clean up voter rolls and audit machines and changes in election laws, including Georgia. And there's a bunch of them, in fact, about six right now, and that will increase, that are either going to retire, quote unquote, from their Democratic Marxist representative position, or they're looking at running for some other office, like senator or governor in their particular states. Of course, they'll be primaried by really alt-left candidates, so we'll see how that comes out. But I like the fact that psychologically, you're beginning to see a shift here in the mentality of some Democrats. That might bode well for getting the five, that's five, votes we need. That is swing votes from Democrats who want to keep their jobs on upcoming bills in the House. But on the other hand, Pelosi is a witch, and she's a smart witch, and she's a tough witch. So who knows what these people will do, or who knows what they'll be paid. You do know that Senator Manchin, that the Republicans were kind of counting on to be a key swing vote in the Senate. You know, he said he was not for the filibuster and he wasn't for packing courts and all that stuff. Well, you know, look, it's all nonsense. Okay? You people of West Virginia keep electing this guy. He's a Democrat. In fact, he's a Democratic Marxist. You know, he told you he wasn't for gun control. We'll see what he does on that. He told you he wasn't for the filibuster. Now he's backpedaling on that. And he told you he wasn't for packing the court. He's backpedaling on that. Manchin is not a reliable swing vote in the Senate. And to make sure he's not, you're going to love this, the Biden administration just offered his wife a cushy, cushy $160,000 a year position in Washington. Oh, there's no coincidences going on here, or is there, folks? And there's no corruption in our government, is there? Let's talk about reparations real quick. Actually, let's stick with the voter stuff. So Georgia passed, and you know, this is why it's so important that you elect real conservatives to your state legislature and all your local offices. We talked about this last week. If we have time, we're going to talk about it again this week and on ad infinitum. And the Georgia legislature finally got the gumption to pass, you know, one vote, one person, you must have ID, none of this mail-in ballot, the whole nine yards. And of course, the left has exploded. I told you last week that Schumer said state legislatures are the biggest threat to democracy. Well, first of all, we're not a democracy, but we'll put that aside. But that tells you how worried these Democrats are. Additionally, the little tidbit I gave you about these Democrats starting to resign or look to run for other positions is another indication of that. There's voter integrity bills pending right now in Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Arizona. In fact, Arizona's close to passing theirs. This bill in Georgia, which is a good bill and which has been absolutely lied about by the mainstream media. You probably heard, you know, oh, it doesn't allow people to eat or drink or anybody to bring them food or water in voting lines. Total nonsense. If you read the bill, it says just the opposite. Just the opposite. You know, poll workers and poll watchers, not public, can bring water and food to people in lines. That's what the bill says. It's in black and white. The mainstream media is absolutely lying through their teeth. And, of course, the Democratic Marxists, who control the mainstream media, along with the corporate oligarchs, are, you know, running with a blatant lie. Because how many people read the bill? Very few. But did you know that Coca-Cola, you know, woke Coke, I've brought you stories on them, and Delta Airlines have publicly come out and chastised Georgia for passing this bill. It's just undemocratic. It is disenfranchising voters. It is aimed at minorities. It is suppressing the vote. You know, folks, if you want to fly Delta, that's your choice. But I wouldn't give aid and comfort and money to the enemy. And if you want to buy a Coca-Cola product, that's your choice. But I wouldn't give aid and money and comfort to the enemy. You need to really think about who you do business with. You can vote with your wallet. You can apply equal pressure to these ridiculous woke oligarchical companies that are in bed with mainstream media and the Democratic Marxist Party. And you should. The same thing you do when you look for something American rather than Chinese to buy. We'll be getting to that. The next little thing that we're going to do, and then we're going to get into our rat-a-tat-tat, is just a quick one here on reparations. Yes, reparations. You know, Oakland, California. Oh, this is going to sound really cool. They're going to give $500 a month for at least 18 months in a, quote, guaranteed income program. Wait till you hear these semantics. To tackle poverty in the city. And they're going to give it to basically first come, first serve eligible folks who are 50% or so of the poverty line or the area median income, which works out to be $59,000 per year for a family of three. And next up, I'm going to give you the catch line of this story. You'll love it. It's all about reparations. Oh, yes. Reparations coming to a city near you. Okay, back to Oakland and their guaranteed income program. Aha! Which, by the way, is just a first step and just a semantical difference between guaranteed income program and UBI, Universal Basic Income, a dream of the Democratic Marxists. You know, get us all beholden and completely dependent on an ever-increasing sized and controlling government. All right, well, and by the way, they try and say this isn't UBI. Quote, on the website of the outfit, which is behind this, Oakland Resilient Families Program website. Yes. They talk about people of color, black, indigenous, and people of color. It's called BIPOC, by the way, for you folks that just aren't woke. BIPOC, all caps, an acronym, BIPOC. Black, Indigenous, and People of Color Families. Quote, UBI is meant to go to everyone and provide enough of a payment to cover all basic needs, whereas guaranteed income is just meant to provide an income floor, but not meant to be a replacement for wages and can be also be targeted to those who most need it. Okay. Well, anyway, here's the catch line on this $500 a month. If you're white, you automatically don't qualify. In other words, if you are a single white mother living in Oakland that meets all the financial criteria, whether low income or below poverty line or 50% of median income, you as a single white mother living in that town, you get no help. You don't qualify. Wrong color skin. And you don't think that this isn't part of reparations? Where are they getting that money for the $500 a month? Give it some thought. All right, we got lots to cover. We're going to move right along. In fact, we're going to go into our rat-a-tat-tat. And then, folks, I might just mention a little bit about gun control because Biden's up to something nasty and you won't like it. I'm probably not going to get into economy, but we got plenty of time to do that. So what we have in the rat-a-tat-tat, and then we're going to get into China. I mean, we're getting into China today, big time. Rat-a-tat-tat. Okay. So we talked about Manchin's 160K bribe, or his wife's 160K bribe. And we talked about, oh, actually, we didn't talk about San Diego. you know, the mess at the border. San Diego, volunteering teachers from the teachers union, who voted 68%, brought this story to you about a year ago, for a Marxist, admitted Marxist, teachers union president, they're volunteering to have in-class teaching for illegal aliens. In the meantime, folks, that county remains shut down to American citizens and their children. No in-class for you if you're American, but in-class for you if you're an illegal alien. Terrific. We love that. Oh, and then we have, let's see, New York Times. This is great. The New York Times lost a bid to dismiss a lawsuit by Project Veritas, a defamation lawsuit, over Project Veritas's videos concerning Ilhan Omar's voter fraud, which is blatant. Blatant. We'll get into that in another show. And also along those lines, maybe we're going to start seeing the media, the mainstream, the corrupt mainstream media slap down a little bit. There's a judge, in fact, he's a pretty high-ranking judge, the Federal Appeals Court in Washington, the United States Federal Appeals Court, in his dissent in a defamation case, another one, defamation case, he absolutely lambasted U.S. media outlets for trumpeting, quote, shocking anti-Republican views, and called for libel laws to be reversed to make it easier to sue the press. I quote, "The New York Times and Washington Post are virtually Democratic Party broadsheets, while the news section of the Wall Street Journal leans in the same direction." This is U.S. Circuit Court Judge Lawrence Silberman, by the way. He also had some scathing remarks about major television outlets and Silicon Valley giants. That's kind of a good thing. education. We're back to education. Yep. According to the Department of Health, your three-month-old, folks, I know you didn't know this, but you better get on it, is a racist. Yes. And you can now get a toolkit to help get their racism, your three-month-year-old's racism, under control. Yeah. The Equity Toolkit claims that babies can develop at 3 months old, and they should be talked to about it, i.e. racism, before they're even able to talk. Let me give you a quote. Quote, "Silence about race reinforces racism by letting children draw their own conclusions based on what they see. They're not too young to talk about race." You know, there was a journalist who uncovered this. His name is Ruffalo. Quote, "My children are people of color, and they get along fantastically with children of all racial groups. Perpetuating the idea that babies are racist is astonishingly stupid," what's more than that, actually, "and should be immediately removed from the Arizona Department of Education's Equity Toolkit." Needless to say, there's an uproar out there over this. Israel, kind of a big deal because it has to do with Trump's peace plan, war in the Mideast, you know, the whole Iranian nuclear thing, Russia, China, the United States. You know, no big deal. No big deal. Does the mainstream media cover it? Hell no. Hell no. So the elections in Israel, this is now the fourth election in 2 years. I mean, even for Israel, it's outrageous. But the polls seem to predict that Netanyahu may be able to form the 61 seats that he needs, because there's 120 seats in the Knesset, if he can lure a guy by the name of Naftali Bennett's Yamina Party into the coalition. The Yamina Party has 7 seats. Okay, Netanyahu's Likud Party has 54. And all the pundits are saying, you know, as things stand now. Well, let me tell you, this is important. This is important. There's still 600,000 absentee ballots to count as of last week. I don't know how it came out. Can't get the information, of course, in the United States. But what's cool is that this coalition government will be like every other Israeli election. There's never been an Israeli election where one party gained a majority of the 120 seats in the Knesset. It's pretty interesting. It may result in a fifth Israeli election, the fifth within 2 years. It's a crazy deal. So you know, by the way, as a sidelight, in Israel, voters do not vote directly for a prime minister, quite different than the United States. And they don't vote for a specific representative. Okay? They actually vote for the party, and the party has a slate of candidates. So this is why you see this back and forth. But who controls Israel is key to lots of things, including energy, the Mideast, Russia, China, the Palestinians, Iran, and of course, the United States. All right, I'm going to tell you more about Israel in a future show because it's a pretty fascinating governmental process that affects, well, it could affect whether you live or die. How's that? Did you know that there were, well, obviously you didn't know because mainstream media is absolutely quiet about it. Did you know that there were worldwide protests over the last month? Up to 1 million people in Germany, tens if not hundreds of thousands in a bunch of other countries, all protesting lockdowns and strict government controls over this COVID nonsense. You know, there are people who love freedom in other countries. It's not just us, although we are the bulwark against not only us, but them losing their freedoms. So just to let you know that these tens and hundreds of thousands of people across Europe marched, I think it was 3 weeks ago Saturday, against, you know, continued government lockdowns and all the other pandemic restrictions, which they say these groups are questionable science, and of course, they're exactly right. That included, by the way, massive, I mean good-sized protests in London, Germany, France, Sweden, the Netherlands, Australia, Belgium, Japan, Vienna. You see, folks, there's a lot of us out there. One of the things they're doing with this pandemic is to make sure we don't talk to one another and we don't know what the other thinks. That is all part of the plan. Oh, and you know, I brought you that story on people can't force you to take the vaccine. It is against the law. Well, that doesn't deter our higher education. No, those bastions of, you know, common sense and good thinking and American values. New Jersey's Rutgers University, I mean, they're right in the thick of it, right? They've seen it doesn't work. New Jersey right now has the highest per capita infection rate and I believe highest per capita death rate going on currently in the United States. They've been locked down for more than a year. Rutgers University announced a week ago Thursday that if you're not vaccinated against COVID-19, you can't attend in-person classes this fall. They're the first major university. I'm sure there'll be other morons that do it too. Totally illegal. You happen to have a kid that's going to Rutgers? Well, first of all, you might want to find another university or maybe get them in a vocational school. It might be more useful. But raise holy hell. Sue them. You'll probably get a check. Okay. Federal Appeals Court. Another good court ruling for our side. A week ago Friday, a federal appeals court ruled that an Ohio college professor had his First Amendment rights violated and that he could sue the school for damages. This goes back to 2016. And it has to do with a guy by the name of Professor Merriweather. He had a transgender student at Shawnee State University, had one in his class, and he didn't address her or him, I don't know which, by however they wanted to be addressed. He must have called, you know, Mr. or Miss, I have no idea. But in any event, this student that is called Doe in the lawsuit, D-O-E, you know, unknown Doe, not a John Doe, not a Susie Doe, but an unknown Doe, complained to the university that Merriweather's repeated refusal to use the student's feminine pronouns created a hostile environment. Oh, where's my safe room? And it was in violation of the school's non-discrimination policy. Well, you know, Doe, whoever he, she is, and Shawnee University are now getting slapped upside the head because Professor Merriweather, much to his credit, has full authority to sue them. And he is. And coming right up, the rest of our rat-a-tat-tat, including Kami Harris's not liking her 70,000 square foot house, you know, very important. And a really quick one on gun control and then into China. Okay, folks, let's barrel through not all, but a few more of this rat-a-tat-tat and then get into gun control in China. All right, the Wisconsin Supreme Court, another good court ruling for us. They told Democratic Governor control freak Tony Evers no on the statewide mask mandate, 4-3 ruling. Basically, they said, no more mask mandate, Tony baby, and you are also violating the law because you passed the last extension of the mask mandate. You guys are going to love this. 1 hour after your Senate and your House, the Wisconsin State Senate and House, passed a resolution 52-42 to make your mask mandate illegal. Not only were you illegal to begin with, you thumbed your nose at the legal process to tell you you were illegal. Go Wisconsin. Then we have Kami Harris, our vice president. You know, she's living in the Blair House. It's right across the street from the White House, Pennsylvania Avenue, kind of an exclusive address. In fact, the press calls it, many people call it the world's most exclusive hotel. It contains 119 rooms, 14 guest bedrooms, 35 bathrooms, other functional spaces, 70,000 square feet, and it's actually larger than the White House. By the way, you can check that out on the GSA on their website. But it's not good enough for Kami Harris. No. She's living out of suitcases, according to CNN, and she's frustrated because the renovation for she and hubby Georgetown law professor Douglas Emhoff, gee, hope your kids aren't in that class, they're unable to move into their private residence reserved for the vice president because it's still undergoing renovations. Gee, I wonder how much they're costing us. This, folks, is what the border czar that Biden appointed is really working on, her renovations and living out of suitcases and complaining about the dysfunctionality and the cramped quarters of her 70,000 square foot Blair House mansion. That should kind of give you an idea of their mindset, don't you think? I do. Okay, real quick on gun control. And then we're going to do rat-a-tat-tat next week. We're just not getting to all of it. It's all make your eyes glaze. So after these mass shootings, and now there was another one in California, I want you to check out MK Ultra, the CIA mind control project. I did whole shows on this. Listen to them. And next week, I'm going to go into more detail on the mind control, the ability to suppress and erase memory, plant new memories, and then call to action certain actions through low-wave radio frequencies in susceptible personalities and minds, particularly those who are unsettled and on psychotropic drugs. Last week I told you, by the way, that it was 99% of the 4,400 mass shootings around the world that the perps were on psychotropic drugs. I did some further research. No, it was 100% That's 100%. In any event, Biden and the Democratic Marxists know full well that they're going to have a hell of a time getting through what they really want to get through in Congress. I mean, the gun thing is the flashpoint in my mind in a lot of ways. So he is now weighing the idea of declaring gun violence a public health emergency, you know, like they did with COVID. And then he can take dramatic executive action to tackle gun rights, which, by the way, not only would include banning quote-unquote assault rifles. And by the way, Joe, the assault rifle ban you called for after the Colorado shooting, he used a pistol, Joe. He didn't use a rifle, just kind of to bring you up to speed. If Biden declares a public health emergency, he could shift a lot of funding, folks, to the AFT, or the ATF, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. That would increase the inspection of gun dealerships, enforcement, all sorts of things that would be unpleasant, shall we say. And they want to classify gun kits, which include 80% uppers and lowers, as firearms that require a serial number. In addition, they want to ban detachable, they want to limit magazines to 10 rounds, and they want to ban detachable magazines. That kind of alters the state of play between government arms and private arms. Remember, the real reason for the Second Amendment, just read the Federalist Papers, was not for hunting, home defense, or whatever. It was to protect the public from a tyrannical government. The founders were foreseeing. All right, let's get into China, because I've been meaning to get there for 2 weeks, and we're going to do it, or at least we're going to start it. Remember our historical story? Britain not confronting its enemies and tamping down their power until it was way too late. The Romans being divided and falling, the same with the Mongols. Well, here we are. I think we know where China's at. For decades, China has been fighting a stealth war, a war against us with the objective of replacing America as the dominant world power. Period. End of sentence. The removal, quote, the removal of the United States as what they call the hegemon is the most important thing to them. That's China expert Michael Pillsbury. The Chinese would prefer to win a 21st century war involving acquisitions of strategic industries like food and communications over a regional or traditional military conflict. H.R. McMaster, he was the national security advisor for Trump for a while. He notes, Chinese President Xi told Trump in 2017 that, quote, the CCP is relentlessly pursuing the great rejuvenation of the Chinese nation, the China dream, unquote. McMaster, by the way, also relates a conversation he had with Li Keqing, high mucky muck in the CCP, and I quote, who indicates that the U.S. role in the future global economy will be to provide China with raw materials, agricultural products, and energy to fuel China's production of the world's cutting-edge industrial and consumer products, end quote. We know already, folks, that China controls strategic pharmaceuticals and essential personal protective equipment. We learned that in the pandemic, which, of course, China, along with their allies, including Fauci, manufactured, shall we say. And they also control a lot of the food in the United States, i.e. they bought the Smithfield outfit, the largest hog producer and processor in the United States. In addition, what you probably don't know is that they are in all sorts of companies, and they control them, or they've bought them, or they basically own them through board control. I mean, the Sheraton Universal Hotel, Smithfield's Foods, which I mentioned, Teledyne, Telex Corporation, TikTok, Vitamins, Waldorf Astoria, Ingram Micro, Intel, The list goes on and on and on. Next week, I'm going to go into details on all this stuff. In addition, they are not just, their influence is just not over corporate and company. It's over government, key government. There was a database obtained by computer hackers from the Chinese Communist Party computers that reveals all sorts of United States senators, governors, congressmen, state officials that are compromised by the Chinese party. It's just a couple of examples. And once again, I'm going to get into this in detail, and I promise we're going to spend half the show next week going over this stuff in detail. It's going to make your eyes cross. I mean, you're not going to be happy. How about that scumbag, spineless rhino Raffensperger, the Secretary of State of Georgia? By the way, Stacey Abrams, with whom he did the consent decree, has ties to communist China. Of course she does. She's a democratic Marxist. His brother works for Huawei Enterprise Storage Solutions, which is a huge paying job. You know, all sorts of influence there for Brad Raffensperger. And then Kemp, the governor of Georgia, has met with them. You know, China's infiltration efforts, I mean, they're in Airbus, Rolls-Royce, Boeing, in addition to all these government stuff. You know, the Michigan Secretary of State, Jocelyn Benson, another alt-left whatever, currently she's obstructing, you know, efforts to investigate Michigan's election efforts. I mean, she has huge ties with Chinese state-run universities and trained lawyers. She's delivered lectures at Premier Chi's alma mater, for God's sakes. And she started doing this work when she was the dean of the Wayne Law School in Detroit, Michigan. Governor Kemp met with Houston Consul General. That was the center of the spy activities of the CCP until Trump shut it down, by the way. He met with their Consul General in 2019, July 12th of 2019. On July 29th, Georgia signed the contracts for Dominion voting machines, folks. Do you think that's any kind of coincidence? By the way, that same Chinese Communist Party, CCP, they paid Dominion $400 million through a subsidiary of HSBC, a big bank, which once again they have their tentacles into, a month before the November 3rd election in 2020. Oh, another coincidence. Do you see how all these dots tie together? There's so much to go over here. Fauci. Fauci is in bed with the Chinese communists and always has been. I'm going to give you the bullet points next week, but let me just tell you, he is funding that lab again. And there's an outbreak in Brazil, which is a deadlier strain, supposedly, of COVID. And China, just like the old superpowers, or should we say the ascending superpowers, is heavily involved all of a sudden in South America. You think there's any coincidences? There are no coincidences, folks. And next week, we are going to go over all of them in detail. You have a great week. Thanks for listening. This is Reed Lance Rosenthal on the Right Side Radio.
Please remember, if you've missed any shows, just click on Show Archive and you'll find all of his shows. We look forward to seeing you here again next week for another episode of Reed Lance Rosenthal on the Right Side.